Okay, I'm going to declare that it is 10 o'clock. This is Charles Chandler, presiding officer in the FRM hearing, so-called, by order of the Secretary of State, October 5th, 2010. We are on the record. This matter is being taped. Prior to our first telephonic testimony this morning, Attorney Forcier, Attorney Spill, do we have preliminary matters?
Yes, sir. I have for you the Attorney General interviews that you have requested. First one being Barry Glennon, interviewed on February 23rd, 2010. Next one being the interview of Steve Lattice on March 11th, 2010. Christopher Lent, interviewed on March 17th, 2010. Peter Roth, June 1st, 2010. Donna Soucy, May 5th, 2010. Suzanne Gorman, March 4th, 2010. Jeffrey Spill, April 27th, 2010. Peter Hildreth, June 11th, 2010. Mary Gerda, April 30th, 2010. Carrie Molin, April 1st, 2010. Lori Cloutier, March 25th, 2010. Timothy Griffin, April 27th, 2010. And now we have James Shepard, April 27th, 2010. As I understand it, you had originally asked us to hold off on this, but now you would like it?
That's correct. I will accept all of those as evidence and ask that they be marked and entered into the exhibit log. And again, understanding that the rules of evidence don't technically apply in this hearing, I will extend whatever probative value is appropriate. We can number each one of those individually. That was going to be your question.
Yes, of course.
Attorney Spill, do we have any other preliminary matters?
Yes, just for the record, prior to going on the record, I brought to your attention a memorandum of law in the bankruptcy proceeding involving the bankruptcy trustee versus McGlecchio, and would ask that that also be made part of the record. It would be the memorandum of law in support of the defense motion for summary judgment in that matter. I feel it would be instructive for this proceeding to understand and better flesh out the issues surrounding the bankruptcy, because there has been a lot of testimony and issues about the bankruptcy have surfaced. And I think this would provide a lot more background and a lot fill out those issues in a more well-rounded. I think you've heard a lot about what the trustee has been doing. This will give you more of the flip side of the case from the view of the lender or individual who is potentially losing an interest in property.
Based on your offer of proof of what this document recommends, what this document represents, I will accept it as evidence. I just want to confirm that at the top of the document, we're looking at the same document. It is case 10-01075 JMD, document number 24-2, filed 12-2010.
Yes.
Okay. And I'll ask that be marked. To make our first call, and in the name of the first telephonic witness is Trudy Melton. Good morning. Is this Trudy Mulheron?
Good morning.
Is this, in fact, Trudy Mulheron?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer here in the state of New Hampshire. FRM hearing matter. We are currently on a speakerphone in an open public hearing. This hearing is being recorded. My understanding is that you are willing to be a telephonic witness in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. In order to be a witness, I am going to issue an oath, and you will be under oath. Are you willing to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm now going to ask you, Ms. Mulhern, do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Ms. Mulhern, when we have had witnesses in these proceedings, I have, in many instances, received pre-printed, prepared opening statements and have asked them to read those statements into the record if they wished. In other cases, witnesses have extemporaneously offered unprepared opening statements. Do you, in fact, have a prepared opening statement?
Yes, I have prepared something.
Would you be willing to read that into the record for me?
Okay.
Thank you. Please proceed. Could you speak up, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Scott Thera was recommended to my husband and me by a friend who claimed to have done business with him for many years and was pleased with the results of her investment. Based on those facts, we made an appointment, meeting him at his office in Meredith, New Hampshire. He said he had clients looking for private money, as banks were not lending. He told us of a deal he was putting together with National Inspection Repair. Scott disclosed that he was receiving 25% interest and would pay us 12%. We later learned that at the time of the discussion, the business was defunct. On August 30th of 2002, we agreed to make a loan of $50,000. I went to Berlin City Bank, closed out our CDs and got a bank check for $52,392.95, endorsed it, and UPSed it to Financial Resources the same day. A few days later, we received a letter dated September 5th, 2002, acknowledging the check, that if we had any questions to call, and a quarterly statement would be forthcoming. An additional $24,000 was loaned to FRM, Inc. on April 19, 2003. We delivered that check to his Meredith office, this also to finance the NIR project at 13% interest with the loan until the loan was paid in full. We were receiving quarterly statements as promised. Everything checked out. Our statement of October 15, 2005 tells us that the NIR project is completed and our funds are being transferred to the Apple Ridge project at the same rate of return. In January of 2006, Scott called us requesting a check in the sum of $1,854 to round out a figure, as he had another project for us. On March 22, 2006, we received closing documents for Tangway Homes, LLC, TaylorMade Ave in Concord, New Hampshire. An interest check was enclosed and the document signed by Donald Dodge of CL&M, Inc. This was our introduction to CL&M and Donald Dodge. Additional enclosures: a schedule of trust beneficiaries of TAN 2006 Realty Trust, name on document, Greatland Project Development, Inc., as well as a promissory note commercial construction loan dated January 19, 2006. Michael Burke was settlement agent for the lender. With that, a schedule of beneficial interest of TAN 2006 Realty Trust, the following named persons: Clifford and Gertrude Mulherin, holder of $2 million mortgage at 14% interest with a share of 5.25%, totaling $105,000. Starting around 2004, a packet of lending opportunities started arriving. In one of the mailings, a pamphlet describes the company as full service, specializing in problem loans. Another enclosure states that they were incorporated in 1989 with branches throughout the United States. That makes me wonder just how far-reaching this scheme really is. On October 16, 2008, my husband and I hand-delivered a check for $10,000 to Scott's office. The check was made out to CLNM and was to be partial funding for one of Scott's many projects. A letter dated November 17, 2008, acknowledged the receipt of the $10,000 loaned to Ideal Homes in Laredo, Texas, secured by Unit 10, Building A, at 13% interest for 1 year. This document signed by Diane Smith's office manager. I question how this charade could have gone on all these years, so many people involved without arousing suspicion that something just wasn't right. We learned of FRM's closure while talking with our daughter on the phone. She said, "Mom, you had better sit down. I have some bad news. Bob just got off the phone with the Meredith Police Department. The FRM office is closed. The content seized and Scott Farah is nowhere to be found." I thought, our life savings, gone. What to do? How will we survive? I called the Meredith Police Department as well and told them, as I recall, Mr. Phil was conducting the investigation. What Scott Farah did to us made me so unbelievably angry and bitter. I couldn't discuss it without breaking into tears. Only a few family members are aware of what has happened to us still. There is a whole bagful of emotions connected to this. Disbelief, shame, and as mentioned, anger and bitterness.
Take your time.
Just a moment.
Take your time.
Being a victim of this crime has had a terrible impact on my husband and me. We are both in our 80s, too late for us to start over. Our money and the interest it generated is gone. It has left us with little more than Social Security. Other members of our family have lost their money as well. Our daughter and son-in-law lost most of the money they worked a lifetime to earn. The granddaughter lost money saved for her children's college education. Our son-in-law's mom, stricken with Alzheimer's, his sister's money, who is caring for her husband, suffering with ALS. Two great-grandsons who have lost their dad and now part of their dad's estate. This has been more than a lifestyle adjustment. It's been a family tragedy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mulherin, very much for the reading of your prepared statement into the record. If you'll bear with me for just a minute as I look at a few documents.
Excuse me, I'm not able to hear you.
Please bear with me while I look at a few documents.
Yes.
When you, well, let me defer for just a minute. Here in the hearing with me are two attorneys from the Bureau, Attorney Forcier and Attorney Spill. Would either of you care to ask questions at this point in time?
I have no questions.
I have just one question. Ms. Mahler and Eric Forcier, State of New Hampshire. Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Eric, why don't you just come forward and close your question.
This is what picks it up. Ms. Muller and Eric Forster, State of New Hampshire. I just had one question. Can you hear me now?
No, I'm sorry. I am hard of hearing, and I'm having a very difficult time hearing.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, yes.
I just wanted to know where you heard that NIR was defunct. How did you get that information?
When we heard about NIR, we heard about NIR from reading the newspapers, from the reporters on the newspaper. I don't remember which one, but after reading so much material, that's where we heard that.
Okay, I've heard the word defunct used a lot with respect to NIR, and I was just curious where you heard that. I appreciate you answering that question.
Ms. Mulhern, this is Mr. Chandler again. I note in some of the documents that you provided to the Bureau for my review today, in one of them, there is something called a loan master report. In that loan master report is a payment to Gould and Burke PLLC. Could you tell me what your understanding is of the firm Gould & Burke PLLC?
Well, I thought that he was representing us, the lender.
And can you help me understand why you came to that conclusion?
Well, Scott told us that he had hired lawyers, and it was just my understanding that through Scott, they would be working for us.
I notice on that loan master report, there was a sum paid to Gould & Burke of $11,553. Do you have any understanding of what that sum was paid for? If you don't, that's fine. I just...
I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Well, let me try this. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. In the loan master report that you provided to the Bureau is a payment recorded to Gould & Burke PLLC in the amount of $11,553. Do you have any understanding why that sum would have been paid to Gould & Burke?
No.
Okay. I have nothing further, either Attorney Forster or Attorney Spill.
Yes, sir.
No, sir.
No further questions. I want to thank you very much for taking the time this morning to be willing to go on the record. I want to thank you for your prepared statement, and that will become entered into evidence for me to utilize in my deliberations. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think so. You're gonna mark that.
Yeah, into exit. Yeah, I'm going to the line.
Okay. Yep. Call away. Is this Jackie and Ron Stone?
It's Jackie. Ron's going to pick up the other phone.
Okay. Let's. This is Mr. Chandler in New Hampshire at the FRM hearing, so-called.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is Mr. Stone on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Jackie and Ron Stone, my name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer in the FRM hearing matter, so-called. You are currently on a speakerphone in an open public hearing, and your testimony is being recorded. It's my understanding that both of you are willing to be witnesses today. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. In order to be a witness, you will be placed under oath. Are you willing to testify under oath?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. That being said, do both of you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. and Mrs. Stone, the witnesses who have appeared throughout this entire process have in many instances had a prepared opening statement that they have read into the record, and I invite that. Other witnesses who have not had prepared opening statements have spoken extemporaneously. I note that, in fact, you have a prepared statement. Would you be willing to read that into the record?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm now going to ask you to proceed with that statement.
Okay. I want to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to speak to you today about the situation. I realize that our case is unique and that we settled out of court and were made whole regarding our case against FRM, Center Harbor Christian Church, Robert and Scott Barra, and also considering the fact that we invested with Scott Barra FRM because of my relationship with Bob Barra and CHCC. I believe that I need to start my story from the beginning of my first meeting with the Barras. First, so maybe you can get an understanding of the type of characters the Barras have, and hopefully you will understand what happened and then at a minimum how. I feel in order to make the changes that are needed to avoid anything like this from ever happening again, you need to hear past and present experiences with Scott and Robert Barra. I also want to tell you that I take being a Christian very seriously, and for that reason was very naive and gullible towards anyone who told me they were Christians. I cannot imagine that anyone who said they had a relationship with the Lord could be anything but honest. I no longer feel the same way. The Barras truly taught me what the phrase wolves in sheep's clothing really means. I will start by telling you about how I first met the Barras, and then I will put into chronological order, to the best of my ability and memory, what we went through and what happened before, during, and after our lawsuit, who my husband and I spoke with during and after our lawsuit, and what we tried to do to get anyone to stop them. I have already sent you court papers and documents with my original letter describing to you our experiences with Financial Resources Mortgage. I have written this letter with much of the same information except for a bit of added information after listening to the testimonies of Dodge and Scott Barra. We have moved several times since leaving New Hampshire in 2005. From the time we settled our case in May 06 until July 2009, I carried the documents from our court case with us. I was sure we would need them at some point in the future, just not when. In July of 09, we moved from an apartment into a house, and some, not all, of the documents got thrown away. I'm going to begin with Robert Barra. I first met Bob in the summer of 1996. It was June. I had just become a born-again Christian in May, and I was looking for a church closer to my home in Sandwich, New Hampshire. I walked into the church, and Bob and I sat and talked for over 2 hours. He is and was very charismatic and likable. As a new Christian, I had not read a whole lot of the Bible, and to me, Bob seemed to have a great deal of knowledge about God and the Bible. I came to know and love Bob as my pastor, confidant, father figure, and friend. The Bible states that we are to honor those who deserve honor, and at that time I thought Bob did. I trusted him completely and spoke with him about things I would not tell anyone else. Looking back over those years, I would have defended him over anything that he had told me, even if it was a lie. My husband was working as a merchant marine, so there were a couple of times that I went to South Carolina for a few months at a time. When I was in New Hampshire, I was at that church every time the door was open. Bob was a pastor of the church. He had this persona that made me feel as though he was always there for me anytime. He was always at the church, working, but ready to drop whatever he was doing at the moment to talk to me no matter what was going on. I felt bad because he seemed to work all the time. I would volunteer to help in the food bank and in the office. The only thing he allowed me to do in the office was send out letters to those who had not been in Sunday service and for a while Sunday bulletins. But of course, at that time, I was made to feel that I was easing his workload. I thought that Bob and I were close. We would have conversations about our families, etc. It was during this time frame that I remember Bob telling me how close he and Scott were and are. He said that not one day goes by that he did not talk with Scott at least once a day by phone. One morning while I was in the office, Bob received a phone call from Vidra Hannington. I believe this was in the fall of 03. After he hung up, he said, poor Betty, she is broke. Does it have anyone to help her or do anything for her? I had always been under the impression that Betty was financially secure, and I knew that she had recently sold her second home. It surprised me so much that I told Bob what I thought. He said, no, she didn't have any money. Betty had not been put into the hospital at this point, but was very ill. In March or April of 04, a good friend of mine had flown up to New Hampshire for spring break, and we went to see Goody in the hospital. We prayed during that visit and tried to encourage her and her daughters. On Wednesday night, following our visit, Bob approached my friend and myself at church and asked us not to pray for Goody anymore, that this had really upset her daughters. It seemed very odd, but out of respect and love for her and her family, we did not go see her again. She died shortly after this. He, Bob, made just about everyone in the congregation feel like he would give you the shirt off his back if you needed it. Right after I started attending the church, he told me that there was a food pantry and that I could help myself. I told him, no thanks, we were fine. After a while of me saying no thanks, he told me, look, the congregation pays for the food. It costs pennies for each pound of food, and it comes from the offerings. So I started going to the food pantry. I don't know of one family, whether they needed it or not, that would not go to the food pantry because Bob made you feel that you had a right to it. I am bringing this up because later, during our lawsuit, one newspaper article quoted Bob as saying, I don't know why they, the Stones, are doing this. They took from the food pantry and the furniture nook. Bob had an uncanny ability to get close to the women in the church. I excused it by thinking he was that way because he never had any daughters, only three sons. If the women were married, it was usually the wife he was closest to. I now believe it is because he and Scott both think of women as being lower than men. I think because women are more inclined to use our maternal instincts and therefore more gullible towards Bob and his manipulating tactics and con artistry. I have seen Bob control his anger in front of me. He would get this look on his face and then act as if nothing was wrong. He did not show anger in front of the congregation, or if he did, we thought it was a righteous anger. Excuse me. Okay, stop there. My first encounter with Scott Barrow was at the Wednesday night Bible study. He controlled the Wednesday night adult Bible studies. He and his wife, Susan, would do them. Bob and Scott would choose who did the service if either of them were out of town. This was not very often. I knew Scott owned a business called Financial Resources, but did not know what type of business until around 2002. I overlooked his personality and arrogance, his overconfidence, by thinking God must have made him that way. I knew that most of the congregation did not view Scott the way we view Bob. I actually felt sorry for him because it did not seem as though he had a lot of friends, so I excused his arrogance and his attitude and tried to befriend him. We used to kid each other and joke on Wednesday nights. I did not see clearly until we left the church and found out what they had tried to do to us that all those insights I had about Scott were warnings about him. I thought it was me and my lack of self-confidence. I believed that I had to love everyone, and I did. That meant I could not judge what they did or looked like on the outside. God knows the heart was my thinking at the time. Ron and I even went out a couple of times with Scott and Susan Barrett for dinner, and during our daughter's first grade, we carpooled because our kids went to the same Christian school. Susan kept to herself a lot, and again, I thought it was her personality. Cedar Harbor Christian Church. I truly had an experience with the risen Savior, and my life changed the night I became born again. That did not mean everything changed overnight. One thing I was sure of, however, and I am sure of, is that God was and is real. His word is truth, and anyone who told me they were a Christian, I took up face value because of my own experiences. I have matured a lot since then. I did not know enough about the Bible when I first started attending the church to question the fact that there was no accountability for Bob and or Scott Barrett in the church. I later came to realize that they owned it. Together, they controlled every aspect of what went on at CHCC down to the last detail. I saw the pattern clearly after we left the church for good. I don't know if you can understand the level of deception Bob and Scott operated in unless you have been exposed to it. Together, they controlled every aspect of what went on in that church without you ever knowing what they were doing, even down to who spoke from the pulpit and who did not. They could not have God moving in that church. During Wednesday night Bible studies, if anyone questioned something concerning God or the Bible, Scott always encouraged us to go to Bob or himself to find the answers. Over the years that I attended, I grew stronger in my confidence in the Lord and His Word. Towards the end of our attending the church, I started to still see things that were not right and would ask Bob about things I felt were not right according to the Bible. His answers always pacified me because he would tell me what I wanted to hear. One incident was over a couple in the church. A parishioner came to Mrs. A's class one Monday night crying, and I asked her what was wrong. She said that she and her husband were having marital problems. She stated that they had gone to Pastor Bob for counseling, Bob later told her to let her husband go on his own way, basically. I told her it did not seem right for her to give up so easy. When I confronted Bob by phone the next morning, he told me she must have misunderstood what he said. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
He told me she must have misunderstood him. That was not what he meant. This was not the only time I received that type of answer from him, but took him for his word. Mrs. A was allowed to teach a woman's group on Monday night. Mrs. A is a very strong Christian and has an ability to teach the Word of God. She taught a woman's Bible study on Monday night. The only people who came regularly were Mrs. A, myself, and Barbara Farah. Mrs. A and I would always try to encourage the other women to attend, and once in a while someone other than the three of us would go. Her husband, Mr. A, has been ordained as deacon after becoming members and was in that position until they left the church in November of 2004. An ex-deacon told us that after the A's left, while in a deacon meeting, he got upset because Bob and or Scott apologized for allowing Mrs. A to teach and putting Mr. A in position of deacon. I became very close to the other parishioners at the church. I was not very close to my immediate family, and the church people became my family, so to speak. There were some parishioners that I felt closer with, had them to my house for dinner, and or went to theirs. I mention them this because some of them still go to CHCC and will not have anything to do with me. I tried in particular to call a woman who still goes to no avail. We attended the varsity at Bob's house on the lake and with others from church after services on Sundays during the summer. I poured my heart into the church and the people there. I would have helped any of them at any time and thought they knew me well enough that I would not lie nor cause harm to another human being for any reason, least of all monetary gain. But after filing the lawsuit, I would learn that was not the case. I have often wondered what lies were told about my husband and I. Bob Fair always taught from the pulpit on Sundays. On the very rare occasion that he was not there, Scott would then teach from the pulpit. Other than Scott Fair, Robert Fair, or Bill Days, Susan Fair's dad, I cannot remember anyone else that was allowed freedom from the pulpit during all the years we attended. If anyone besides three mentioned, Bob would always get up first, then the person, then Bob again. Bob would use the pulpit to talk about how wonderful his son was at business. He also used it as a means to speak against anyone who left the church under anything other than just moving. He would tell us how bad he felt because so-and-so fell away from God and was taking their spouse with them if the person was married, otherwise it was the individual. I believed anything Bob said, as sad as it was, we all did. It wasn't until we left in Bob's suit that I started understanding the truth of what he was doing. Whenever Scott would have something going on at work, we were told that he was being attacked because he was such a godly man, and we needed to pray for him. One time in particular was while he was in a court with the company. We were told Scott was being unjustly accused by this company. This was around 2003. What we did not know was the name of the company at the time. Scott won that case by jury. We found out later it was NIR, National Inspection and Repair, David Price, the company that Scott had defrauded and caused to go bankrupt around 2001. In Kansas City, Kansas, then sued. It was one of the companies we supposedly had invested with in 2002. I also distinctly remember the church paying off its mortgage of over $120,000. I don't remember the exact year, but I believe it was during a trip to South Carolina. It sticks out in my mind because I felt bad and It sticks out in my mind because I felt bad about not being there for the mortgage burning ceremony the church held, and Bob later showed me a newspaper article. We were told by Bob from the pulpit that Scott had some investors who had given him the money to pay off the mortgage. We attended the church, with the exceptions I have told you about, from June of 1996 to around June of 2001, then from October of 2001 to November of 2004 when we left for good. I never understood what Scott did, just that he was a businessman, until 2002. Up to that point, I had no idea he invested money to get mortgages. Excuse me, I gotta take a sip of water.
Take your time.
You
do.
Okay. Leading up to the lawsuit, in the winter of 2000-2001, my husband and I started talking of moving. We had had enough of the winters in New Hampshire. I had a desire to go back to my home state of South Carolina. Period. In June of 2001, we moved to South Carolina. I was still on very good terms with Bob and the people at the church. I kept up with most of them by phone when we moved. On October 31st of 2001, we moved back to New Hampshire. We had only been back for a couple of weeks when we got a phone call from a family telling us Ron's mother was in the hospital. When we learned the circumstances surrounding her trip to the hospital, we made the decision to move her and Dad into our home. We moved them into our home right after Thanksgiving in 2001.
It became very stressful trying to care for my in-laws and my 3 and 7-year-olds. I hope by calling Bob and Steve Woodman a lot for prayer. I wanted to tell Bob, my pastor, everything about what was going on. I did not talk to Scott unless it was at church during this time. We used to joke around with each other. I never went alone to Scott for prayer. I just did not have that type of relationship with him like I had with his dad. I told Bob about my in-laws making my husband power of attorney over their estate. I did this for prayer. I was concerned it would cause problems of jealousy and or anger within my husband's family. I did not want that. It was right after my talking with Bob about the specific, that we specifically remember Bob talking from the pulpit about what a wonderful businessman his son Scott was. Ron remembers Bob from the pulpit talking about someone mentioning to him, Bob, that Scott would make a good pastor, and Bob replied to him, no, Scott is a good businessman. Right after the papers were signed making Ron power of attorney, Ron was talking with Bob on a Wednesday night and was told by Bob that he, Ron, should talk to Scott about investing Dad's money. My mother-in-law passed away in February of 2002. Financial resources and mortgage. Ron started making arrangements to ensure Dad would have finances in place to be taken care of. It was becoming increasingly difficult to care for Dad. After hearing from Bob how wonderful Scott was as a businessman, the relationship I had with Bob and Scott talking to Ron, he invested $50,000 in July of 2002. The first investment of $50,000 of Dad's money was sent to Scott Barron FRM, supposedly into an entity called Blue Flower Inn. We found out during our lawsuit that Scott never had the legal right to use this company. The woman who owned the business backed out of the deal Scott was trying to involve her in, is what we were told. Between July of 2002 and December of 2002, Ron invested a total of $125,000 of Dad's money through Scott Barron FRM. $75,000 supposedly went to an entity named National Inspection and Repair, the company Scott had already forced into bankruptcy around 2001. We had moved to Salem to be close to Dad. He moved into a nursing home down there. Scott was calling Ron while he was working all the time, trying to get Ron to invest all of Dad's money. In mid-late December of 2002, Ron called me asking me what I thought. I felt that Ron had invested half of Dad's money already and would not be a good idea to invest all of it. I told him I would call and talk to Scott, and I did. I spoke with Scott and asked him about our current investments for Dad, and told him emphatically that we would not be investing any more of Dad's money. I asked him if we needed to get to the money, considering also how long it would take. Scott assured me there would be no problems in getting the money back, and it would only take 30 days. Scott continued to tell Ron about all these good deals he, Scott, had for Ron to invest into. Please keep in mind, even though we lived in Salem, I talked to Bob and or Steve Woodman at least 2 or 3 times a week and sometimes daily. I had them praying with me for our financial decisions. Scott kept that to Ron until Ron made the decision to invest his own 401k with Scott. Ron discussed it with me, and I did not mind him doing that. That was our money, and besides that, I felt nothing would happen to any of the investments because of my relationship with Bob. The sad truth was during this whole time, Bob was giving information I was giving to him under the guise of my pastor to his son, Scott. In the summer of 2003, we once again moved back to Sandwich and CHCC. Ron was being asked to do things for Bob and CHC that he felt now, unlike before, that he, Ron, was being accepted. One such situation was that Bob asked Ron and Lee Landry, now deceased, to deliver a brown package. It was about the size of a shoebox. They were asked to take it to the Laconia Airport, wait for a man named Augie David. And this was Bob that asked him to do this. He flew into the airport with another man in a Cessna plane. They walked up to Ron and Lee, got a package, thanked them, and flew off again. Ron remembers joking with Lee about how they felt he had just done something illegal. That was only one incident of this time. All the other requests were to fix things or help other prisoners with odd jobs. I later talked with Bob about Augie and Mom, and he told me that Augie had gotten into trouble and that I needed to be praying for him. Mr. Davis was allowed to speak at church, never without Bob or Scott being there. We were told he and Scott met in college at Oral Roberts University. Bob later told us from the pulpit that Augie had gotten into some trouble, and I never saw him at the church again. In the fall of 2003, we were living back in Sandwich, New Hampshire. I had become friendly with our neighbors. One morning, she and I were walking, and she was telling me they had to go bankrupt. They were going to lose everything they owned. I felt horrible for them, so much in fact that I went home and called Bob to pray for them. Then I called my husband and asked him if we could do something for them. I then called back and asked Bob if Scott did mortgages, and he said yes. I cannot remember if Ron or I called Scott about this incident in particular. Over the next 3 or 4 weeks, we received a dollar amount from our neighbors. one that would pay their debts and allow them to walk away from the sale of their home with some cash, and we started the paperwork with Scott NFRM, and I put in a registry fee in the paperwork. After the paperwork was signed, I was talking with my neighbor's husband. He told me that Scott had called him 3 times saying that more money was needed to pay for this or that. It upset me, and I told him to tell Scott, if he called him again, to tell Scott that the papers were signed already and to let me know if he called him again, I would talk to Bob. I still believe Bob was who he portrayed himself to me to be. My husband's sister and brother-in-law also refinanced the mortgage with Scott and FRM right after this because of the relationships we thought we had. They refinanced with a reputable mortgage company as soon as they could afford to. The house we purchased from our neighbors had a huge garage on the lot across the street. For our kids' birthdays, we had everyone from the church come for a cookout. I believe this was the first time Scott had ever seen this building. He started approaching Ron at church about going into business with him using that building. At first, I was excited. I would call Bob and tell him how excited I was. I had started feeling almost like a red-headed stepchild. It seemed that half the congregation worked for Scott, and I just felt left out, to be honest with you. I could not get a job with Scott. I tried to put out feelers with him at church, and he acted as if he wanted no part of that. I thank God for that now. I can only tell you that by the grace of God, my husband did not choose to go into business with Scott. We had been praying about it for a few weeks, and Scott was pressuring Ron to give him an answer. The day Ron was to give Scott an answer, we told him no, that we might be moving back to South Carolina. I believe God protected us from making a decision that would have haunted us for the rest of our lives. We found out during our lawsuit, Scott would use people's companies that he had his hand in, legally or illegally, to pull in investor money. Ron also did a job for Scott and FRM. He revamped a building for a business in Meredith Center Harbor to Scott. Ron gave him a great deal, and Scott paid Ron around $10,000 in cash for the job by the time Ron finished it. This occurred around the spring of 2003. I know this because we had not yet moved back to Sandwich. We were waiting for our kids to finish school first. I remember Ron driving up and staying at our house in Sandwich during the week, and the kids and I going up on weekends. This was also around the time that Scott had bragged to Ron about how he paid Tom Holly in cash about $125,000 for the addition on Scott's private home. He also bragged about getting his business lot tarred and paved and paying cash for that job also. Excuse me. Ron started to feel uncomfortable because he had not received much, if any, paperwork about the investments he had made for Dad with Scott. I believe this was around 2004. Ron had received interest payments monthly from those investments, between $1,200 or $1,300, somewhere around there. He called Scott and asked him for some paperwork. Again, because of the relationships we had mostly with Robert Farrer, we did not question in the beginning the fact that we had not received much paperwork from Scott, who had excuses for everything. Scott sent the first batch at the same time with Ron's name. It should have been a dad's name at different dates. When Ron called and talked to Scott about it, Scott told him not to worry and send him another batch of papers, this time with Dad's name on the paperwork. This second batch of paperwork was sent on the same day, yet with the same different dates on the letters. All of the letters had financial resources mortgage on them. Excuse me. I started to feel uncomfortable at the church. I do not know why. Just something was not right. I spoke with Bob in his office in October of 2004. I asked him if we could fast through the church body and find out what was keeping God from moving in the church. I had brought a list of scriptures that I felt the Lord during my prayer time had given me to take to Bob. They had a lot to do with repenting and sin. Bob looked me in the eye, rubbed his hand over his face, and told me that God had been dealing with him about the same thing. He told me he had been waking up at night with it on his heart. I gave the list to Bob and asked him to take it to the Board of Deacons. We were made to believe that the board at this church helped with the decisions that were made as a church. Steve Woodman, Johnny Demokowski, Mr. A, who left the church in November of 2004, Mr. B, who left the church shortly after we deposed him during our court case, and Scott Barrett. We thought he held the position as the only elder. Again, we found out during our lawsuit that Scott was indeed the treasurer and that Johnny Demokowski was also an elder. I called Bob a week later, and he told me he spoke with Scott only about this, and that Scott had said this was too harsh to bring before the church body or board of deacons. Bob never told anyone except Scott Fair about this, to my knowledge. 1 week after the A's left the church, I was in prayer. I was seeking God about what to do about the situation at church and if this was where we were supposed to be. This was on a Saturday morning. I knew after that time of prayer that we had to leave the church. We did not go to church on Sunday, and on Monday morning, I again went in to speak with Pastor Bob. I tossed and cried for about an hour and a half to 2 hours with him that morning. I felt as though I were leaving family, cutting ties with them. I had still not put it together what they were doing to us or others. God told me he hated to see us build it, but he understood we had to be obedient to God. What struck me as odd was that after the conversation in which neither money nor investments were brought up, God walked me to the stairs, put his arm around me, and asked me if I thought Scott was ripping us off. I was taken aback by this question. Ron had just asked for the money back about a month before this, and Scott's excuses had not seemed unreasonable at the time. I answered him with an emphatic no, not at all. That would change in a couple of months. I did not see the full picture of what was happening or the deception we had been in until we left the church. Ron and I came to the conclusion about 4 months later we would have to sue them to try and get the money back. The lawsuit, January of 2005. Ron and I were getting real upset with Scott. I had pretty much cut off all contact with anyone still in the church at this point. We started talking about getting a lawyer, and I remember hearing about the lawsuit when we were still attending the church. I've mentioned it under CHCC. The idea of finding out the name of the lawyer who was against Scott during that trial occurred to me, and I mentioned to Ron about dropping his name to Scott to see if that would move him faster. I called the next prisoner whose husband I had heard testify against Scott during this trial to see if he remembered the name of the lawyer. We had been told at the congregation from the pulpit and in a conversation between me and Bob that this man had fallen away from God and that he made his wife leave the church. I'm sorry.
Take your time.
Okay. I later found out this to be an outright lie. This man gave us the name of the lawyer, Tom Bigford, in Wolfboro, New Hampshire. I have learned since all of this came out that many girls do not want to be involved with this current situation. That they have said it's okay that their lawyer speak to anyone concerning about what happened to their mom's estate. Excuse me. Ron called and spoke with Tom Bickford. He told my husband that he represented the Hannington family and that he was not a litigation lawyer but had a name of one whom, and I quote, would probably not make mind taking another bite out of that apple. This lawyer's name was Chris Carter. My husband called Chris later that day, explained to him our situation, and the next day we drove to Concord to discuss our case. We found that Chris Carter was hired by David Price to sue Scott Barrett FRM because Scott was the cause of his company's bankruptcy. That was when we first heard about the fact that the company was not in business when we first invested in 2002. We had found out the trial had occurred with the jury and the outcome was in Scott's favor. We hired Chris as our lawyer and started gathering information. I received a telephone call from the eldest of Goody Hannington's daughter, and she told me what Bob Barron and Scott Barron had done to her mother, herself, and her sisters. Bob had managed to go to Goody about 1 to 2 weeks before she died, April of 2004, and got her to make him power of attorney over her estate. The girls knew nothing about this until after the death of their mother. They were going through some paperwork left in the house, and they came across documents stating Robert Barron become power of attorney over her estate, and some letters with FRM letterheads stating that so much had been invested with NIR. I believe they were missing over $100,000. According to that paperwork, Robert Barron received $10,000. Diddy's dad had always been named as executor over her estate as far as the girls and their grandfather knew. He still was. They were shocked to find out how, what, and when this changed to Bob's hands, and also about the so-called investments. Their lawyer was sitting in on the above-mentioned court case and heard Scott mention from the stand about Goody's supposed investments. He was able to get the girls some of their money back from Scott. Goody had been in that church for years. She had raised all three of her daughters there. I believe her loyalty to Bob was a huge mistake for her and her daughters. Mr. Carter got paperwork for the suit against Robert Scott Barrett, FRM, and Center Harbor Christian Church. He also did the paperwork to freeze the assets we knew of. Ron and I made the decision to go public with the situation for a couple of reasons. We felt as though we were not the first people they stole from, and that perhaps people would come forth after hearing about it on the news. About a week before we actually filed, I got a phone call out of the blue from Steve Whitman. He asked me if everything was okay, that he felt like we were going through something. I said no, we were fine. He then told me that they, the church, Bob, and himself, missed us and loved us very much. From March 05 to June 06, as all this, I believe, happened with all in this time, we sent the papers to CHCC, FRM, Scott Barron, Robert Barron, March 2nd or 3rd. It was a Wednesday. The next morning, I received a call from Scott asking to speak to Ron. I told him he was not in at the moment, and Scott said he had a check for Ron sitting on his desk. I told him it was a little late for that, and he could contact our lawyer if he had anything else to say. WMUR and I came to our house and did an interview with Ron and I. It aired that weekend. Received a call from WMUR 9 the following Monday or Tuesday. A woman wanted to talk to us. She told me that her daughter had been involved with Scott for about 7 or 8 years prior to this. This was the story. She said Scott had met her daughter at a house in Laconia. The daughter was going to buy the house and gave Scott around $10,000. Scott was telling the daughter that his dad was a pastor and he went to church, making himself sound like a good Christian man. After the daughter gave Scott the money, she was at the house cleaning it up when the bank showed up and told her she had to leave. Scott's daughter did not have a legal right to sell the house. I'm not sure if the daughter got her money back or what happened. The mother said her daughter did not want to get involved, just wanted us to know what happened. Ron and I started looking into anything or anyone we thought could or would help us. Very few people wanted anything to do with our case. I gathered a list of names together, either off documents or just talking to different people. I called everyone listed on the State of New Hampshire agreement, not included in paperwork. I spoke with Donald Dodge. At the time, I had never heard his name mentioned at church or anywhere else, nor by anyone. I explained our whole case to him. He had nothing to say. I believe Mr. Dodge went to business with Scott in June of 2005. One woman scared me and she screamed at me and told me I was a nutcase and to never call her again. I called another woman. She had been at the church around 97-99. She had just stopped coming. I asked Bob about her and he had told me she had fallen off the wagon and that I needed to pray for her. When I called her, I asked how she was doing and she said fine. I then proceeded to tell her what was going on. She started screaming at me that she wanted no part in the situation. Specifically, I remember her saying, I live right down the street from this man. I don't want any part of this. She lived on Alpine Park Road, right down the street from Bob. And if I'm not mistaken, Bob had also hired her to do home care for Ellie Day, now deceased, at one time. There had been a major split in the church before we started attending. Bob had said from the pulpit it was because he had come from, it was because he had come back from somewhere and in his excitement he kissed his secretary on the cheek. Someone had seen him do this and people just blew it out of proportion. That was the cause of the split. The truth that I found out was this. The secretary had overheard a conversation between Scott and Bob Fair laughing over how easy it was to steal from Ellie Dane. She went to the board with this information, and they approached Bob. He told them he would abide by whatever they said. They went to him. They asked him to step down as pastor to seek counseling for 6 months. Bob refused to do that, and so on a Sunday during service, half the congregation got up and walked out. I was told that there were around 500 people at the time, so about 250 people got up and walked out of that service. This occurred around 1994. Looked more into the Ellie Dane situation and found out that was how Bob came to CHCC. He was her estate caretaker and bookkeeper. Ellie gave the original building to Bob, and he would attend church there. And would attend church there. She would. He had told her family he was going to build a senior home for elder parishioners, so they sold some of the property behind his church for him to next. He had told her family he was going to build a senior home for elder parishioners, so they sold some of the property behind the church to him for next to nothing. We found evidence that Barbara, Robert, Scott, and Susan Vera all had Visa cards the Financial Resources Mortgage Company used for their own personal use. Ron and I went to Massachusetts to Bob's hometown. We found that he had been in a shady deal with a lawyer right before he moved to New Hampshire. Bob had gone bankrupt down there, moved to New Hampshire, and bought the lakeside with money he hid from the bankruptcy through his lawyer, is what we could piece together. My husband received a phone call from a man soon after we filed suit against him. We had met this man while he was doing some logging work for Bob at the church. We hired him to do some logging on our property and got to be friends with him. He wanted to let my husband know that Scott Barrett and Steve Woman had just left his house. They knew about $1,500 we had loaned him. Bob Barrett was the only one that knew about that, and he only knew because I told him. They wanted this man to lie and say that my husband had given him the money so that this man would not tell me about an alleged affair that he knew about. The affair supposedly occurred between another woman and Ron. I wrote and signed the check out for the loan to this man. This man told my husband that he told them he refused to do that. I remember my husband saying that this man had made a comment to my husband about what type of Christians did things like that. The Fairs or Woodman did not know we knew about that visit until the second day of depositions of Steve Woman at Bound's office. Mr. Carter asked Mr. Woodman about it, and if I remember correctly, at that time he said he would do anything for his pastor. I was at a church picking up something for Ron when I ran into a couple who still attends the church. This couple had 5 children and Bob had helped them out a lot. They had been friends of mine from the church and I had had them to our house for dinner. I smiled and said hi and they walked out of the store. When I was finished with my purchase, I went outside and they were waiting for me. Sorry.
Take your time.
The wife's door was open, which was next to my car, so I walked up to her. She said, referring to the lawsuit, how can you do this to that man, Bob, after everything he did for you? I told her that God provided for me, not Bob Farah. I also told her that Scott was the treasurer of the church, and she said, no, he is not. Her husband said, yes, he was. She was not going to hear anything I had to say about Bob, so we all left. I don't recall the details of this, but we remember being told by someone that Scott had kept 2 sets of records for his company. One was factual, the other was not, is what we were told. I believe this came from an IRS agent, again, off the record. Excuse me. We had found out so much about Bob and Scott Barry that I was becoming scared. I was really seeing the depth of deception we had been in for so long. We lived in the woods in Sandwich, New Hampshire, with no close neighbors. We had put a sensor at the end of our driveway so we could know if anyone came to our house, and we kept a loaded gun close by. We called the resident chief of police of Sandwich at the time and asked him to come to our home. When he got there, we told him what was going on and what we were doing. Excuse me for a minute.
Okay. Again, take your time.
I remember him saying that Scott would not come himself. Oh, I don't think I got that far. I'm sorry. We called the resident chief of police of Sandwich at the time and asked him to come to our house. When he got there, we told him what was going on and what we were doing. I remember him saying that Scott would not come himself. He would send someone if he did anything. Scott, excuse me. I could not believe what I was hearing from this police officer. He also said he heard a new of the Ferris because he was a cop in Moultonboro at one time but wouldn't tell us anything about that. I did not understand why they were allowed to get away with what they had been doing to people. I believe by this time Ron had contacted the Attorney General's office and the banking department. My husband asked legal questions during his first conversation with the New Hampshire banking department. Ron was told that by law, because FRM had a license with this banking department, that he, Scott, could have informed them of any civil action within 5 days of the alleged suit. Ron was told there was no such information. The second time he called New Hampshire Banking, he spoke with lawyer Andrea Shaw. She informed him that he needed to write a letter to NHBD. I can only find 1 page of this concerning the situation, and I cannot find any copy to prove if Ron did or not write the letter. We are assuming that he did. He contacted Better Business Bureau and was told he could not file a complaint while in the middle of the lawsuit. No one seemed to be doing anything. We felt totally alone in this mess. We had spoken to numerous people in authority. We felt that our case was totally black and white with both pairs, guilt evident, and yet there was nothing we could do to get it. There was nothing we could get anyone to do. We spoke to private citizens as well. We informed anyone willing to listen what they had done. Ron had started working with the company he works for now. He would travel and would not be home for a week at a time. We decided it was time to move, and we left New Hampshire in June of 05. We traveled back to New Hampshire. Ron would go if needed. When we got to South Carolina, Ron contacted the IRS to complain about Scott for not paying taxes. Scott was claiming to have only made around $30,000 to $50,000 on his W-2 forms during this time frame. I don't remember what happened or with that or the details of the call. I do remember that Ron and I had heard that someone was warned by, again, an IRS agent in New Hampshire off the record to be careful that Scott Farah ran with some dangerous men about a year or two before we went through our court case. I think it was during one of these trips back to New Hampshire that Ron sat in conversations Mr. Carter had with what Ron believed then and now to have been Nancy's office, Center of a Christian Church and Financial Resources Mortgage. The people who worked for FRM and attended the church. Rhonda Baffy was at the church when I started attending. To my knowledge, her husband very seldom attended church with her unless it was a special occasion. She started working for Scott around 2002-2003. At first, she just did office work. Then at the end of FRM, she was his office manager. She still attends CHCC. I was told she was warned about Scott's greed in 04. I was told her reply was something like, what am I going to do? I just built my new house. Johnny Dilkowski was there when I started attending. I had spoken to Mr. Dilkowski at church and did not know until years later he was an elder. It was a few years later also that I learned that Mr. Dilkowski also managed a rental complex in Franklin for the Ferris. He also wrote a letter to the Concord Monitor April 11, 2010, 10, titled Don't Go After Bear's Church, copy enclosed. He also preaching perseverance. Note some of the names in that article. He still attends the church. David Dexter. Mr. Dexter worked for Scott right after he and his family moved to New Hampshire, but he quit. Right before he and his wife separated, he started back with Scott and worked for him up until Scott closed his doors. I was told Mr. Dexter went back to CHCC after the closing of FRM. John and Nancy Comforti. He and his wife attended CHCC. He did handyman work for Scott at FRM, and Nancy worked for Bob cleaning the church on Fridays. I remember seeing John Comforti at the church during one of WMUR9's news coverage of the story this past summer, 2010, so they still go. Stephen Woodman. He started attending after we did. The last year or two in the church, Steve and I called each other to pray for people, for help, or whatever their need was. I thought we had become close. Around the time we left, we had heard that Steve was doing some sort of deal with FRM and the property he owned in Moultonboro, New Hampshire, where he lived on Red Hill. He was ordained as elder in CHCC in May of 05. After we hit FRM, CHCC interfered with the lawsuit. He and Scott had gone to the man's house or home to try and get the man to lie about me and my husband, Ron, or about my husband. Richard Rollins. He has been a mess with both parents at church and FRM. I believe he started attending the church regularly around 2000. He also owned the company, JLN, that some of our monies went through, and we didn't even know he had a company at church, not until the lawsuit. During our lawsuit, we asked for and received permission from the court to obtain the video recording for the Sunday services. They would help prove our case against Bob concerning his using the pulpit for his own greed. However, before we could obtain access to all of them, there had been a fire at Richard Rollick's home the week he happened to have some of the videotapes in his possession. I had never heard of anyone except Mr. and Mrs. B taking videos of the church home. We were not able to view all the videos because of this fire. Jeff Long. He never attended the church, but had moved to New Hampshire from Tulsa, Oklahoma for about a year to work with Scott. He and his wife divorced, and he moved back to Tulsa, Oklahoma until Scott closed the doors to FRM. He was listed as vice president of FRM. Located in the FRM documents concerning our case, part two, there was a wire transfer to Spirit Bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where some of Dad's money was sent. There were some other people who did clean up work at FRM in the church. I don't know about the years we left at the time Scott closed his own doors. In January, February of 2006, Mr. Carter called and told us we had to make an offer. Neither one of us wanted to do that. We felt we had a very strong case and thought if we went to court, there would be no way anyone could ignore their criminal activities. We would get as much publicity on the trial as we could. The mediation laws in New Hampshire were explained to us, and we were told we had to put an offer on the table. We did, and they took it. I was devastated. We were also very angry. With the evidence we had against him, we could not get anyone to investigate this man. It was then we instructed our lawyer to take all of our information and paperwork to the Attorney General's office. We were told later by Mr. Head that he and Mr. Carter took it to the U.S. Attorney's office. We were glad that we were getting the money back for Dad, but felt they would not stop with us. Part of our settlement was that they had to show us where the money came from. It supposedly came from a trust fund in Susan Baird's name, and she signed the check we received. My husband also wanted a letter of apology from the Bears. They refused to write one and instead gave us a smaller settlement in lieu of an apology letter. The only gag that we were and are aware of is that we cannot tell anyone the amount of the settlement. When we sat Ron's family down and explained everything to them, my brother-in-law was so mad he sent a letter to the AG's office along with a copy of the newspaper article from the Concord Monitor. After the settlement, Ron again called the AG's office, New Hampshire, to no avail. We also called the FBI in Boston and nothing came after that. My dad is sitting on the phone. I'm sorry. I'll just take your charge this phone for 1 second. Okay. You there?
We're here.
Okay. Where was I at? I'm sorry. Okay.
You're at that section that's characterized as after the lawsuit.
Okay. So I was on the stage. I would Google Bob and Scott Bear periodically on the web. I felt as though I had failed in getting them stopped when we settled out of court and tried to keep tabs on them that way. I believe it was around May of 09 that I ran across the Spokes business page listing Scott Bear as founder of Lakes Region's Assembly of God Church in Meredith. Jeff Long is listed there also, enclosed. I was so upset I again called the AG's office and FBI in Boston to no avail. I did not hear back from either entity, and it was not until October of 2009 that I looked again and found the same webpage. I once again called AG's office in New Hampshire, only this time I insisted they give me the name and address of their investigator. I sat down and read a letter to Mr. Paul Broder, investigator for the AG's office, New Hampshire. I explained in the letter what they had done during our lawsuit and what I felt they were trying to do with this fictitious church, and with a copy of the specs page mailed it all to Mr. Broder on October 22, 2009. I cannot find my hard copy of the original letter. On November 14, 2010, I had emailed Mr. Broder in regards to the letter and the closing of FRM enclosed. I then called him and spoke briefly to him by phone. I told him that we had information that it might help with the investigation. A.G. Delaney called and spoke with Ron once, in December of 2009, I believe. FBI, I'm not sure if it was Mr. Reagan or not, spoke with Ron once. Again, I think in December. Security agent Jeff Spill spoke with Ron once, and I'm not sure. I thought it was January, but then I saw an email that said something different that you have. I know what's wrong, and I spoke with reporters. I sent emails to anyone I could. When the legislation meetings began, I emailed them, Representative Governor Lynch's office, anyone I thought might be interested in hearing the whole story. As the story continued, I started seeing things that were odd to me. For instance, when lawyers Guldenberg went to court to get excused from this whole mess, it was Philip McLaughlin who represented them. That seemed to me as if it should have been a conflict of interest, considering the fact that Mr. McLaughlin was in fact the Attorney General of New Hampshire when the first complaint about FRM was taken to the AG's office in 2000. It may have been you, Senior Assistant Attorney Peter Roth stated. In a closed newspaper article, Gail Orberg, Laconia Citizen, January 13, 2010, and also January 8, 2010. Ron was sitting in Scott's office one day before our lawsuit, when Scott told Ron that in exchange for representing him at various times, the law offices of Guldenberg had free rent in FRM's offices. In April of 2010, after sending out an email to AG's office and more, I received an email from Richard Head requesting to do a phone interview with both myself and my husband concerning the entities we had contacted during our lawsuit. During that interview on April 12, 2010, I informed Mr. Head and Mr. Marshall of some very troubling information I had discovered at the beginning of April 2010. During our lawsuit, the church's depositions were answered by the church's legal committee. On that document are the names listed, she enclosed, of this legal committee. They were Steve Woodman, Roberta Fletcher, and Miriam Appleby. I was very surprised and advised when we saw this document. I knew these women from church and did not know they were on a legal committee, much less that one such office even existed for the church. In August of 2009, Mim Appleby passed away, and I found a letter to the editor at Laconia Citizen that a family member wrote to the paper, see article enclosed. She was very surprised to see that Ms. Appleby had left $50,000 to Bob Farah. She saw that on Robert Farah's bankruptcy document. That what she needed to be Ms. Appleby's last wishes were totally different than what occurred. This scenario was all too familiar to me due to Skitty Hannington's situation. When I explained that, Mr. Head replied that he was trying to find out who we spoke with and during and after our court case. I retorted to him that they were in a much better position to investigate Bob Farah than I was. It was during this phone conversation that we were informed by Mr. Head that our lawyer, Chris Carter, had taken all of our information concerning our case to the U.S. Attorney's Office and not the AG's office. Later, I mentioned Mim Appleby to Mr. Head again in an email, and he wrote back that he would turn it over to the investigating office of AG, and they would determine if it should be turned over to the FBI. I also spoke with U.S. Attorney Zuckerman, I believe, in April 2010 concerning both affairs. A couple of things I want to emphasize or reiterate, and know this to be true. During the month of April or May of 2005, I contacted Donald Dodge concerning our court case. I told him how Scott defrauded us by having us invest in companies that he had no legal right to use or had forced to go defunct, that Bob Farah was working in concert with his son to rip us off, and that I had learned the truth about the original split in the church, and that I had never heard his, Dodge's, name mentioned at church or around Scott's office, that I had found his name on the State of New Hampshire Articles of Agreement from 1983. I asked him if there was anything he could tell me about the Bears, the church, or anything. If my memory serves me correct, his response was that he had not been around the Bears for a while and had nothing to tell me. Imagine my shock and horror, if you can, when I first heard in November 09 who Scott's partner was and when he had set up his Dodgers company with Scott in June of 05. Scott Fair made a couple more incorrect statements recently. He said we invested into FRM. We were told we were investing through FRM into the above entities with that monies, and the FRM would roll my husband's 401k into another retirement fund. None of this happened. We, in fact, learned during our lawsuit that not only had our funds been commingled with FRM, but a check in the amount of $25,000, I believe, was written out to JLN using our money. Mr. Farah has mentioned that we were disgruntled, I believe was the word he used, and that was why we had wanted our monies back. The truth was, in M4, my husband started questioning facts like Ron never received paperwork, and when he called Mr. Farah on that, Mr. Farah sent bogus paperwork to him. Because of this, I'm starting to feel uncomfortable because of Dad's money was the reason why around October of 04, Ron had started officially requesting the monies from Mr. Fair. We had not left the church at this time. Also, Mr. Fair mentioned he was ready to pay us back in February of 05. We were never offered that, and in fact, we're not offered our monies back until the day after we hit them with the lawsuit. We were able to freeze the assets we knew about, and there was not enough money in the accounts that we knew about to satisfy our investments. The Bears keep on insisting to anyone who will listen that there is a gag order on our court case. The truth is that only the amount of what we settled for is under a gag order, and that, I believe, was initiated by Bears through Mr. Scott Bears' attorney, Mr. Gould. I believe the consequence for giving out that information could result in a fine of $10,000 for either party. How can Scott and his family afford to send Scott's two sons to Oral Roberts University if they are as poor as they keep claiming? The oldest son in the second year, the youngest, is first. According to the ORU cost financial aid sheet enclosed in your paperwork you have received, the average tuition is $20,000 to $30,000 a year per student. If they received tuition aid because the Bears cannot afford it, then how has Scott been able to donate so much money to Santa Barbara Christian Church over the years? I want to assure you that I am not trying to be vengeful towards the Bears, nor am I trying to disrespect anyone in authority involved in this situation. Knowing the facts that the Bears did not care whom they caused harm to or whom they may have caused to fall away from God, and finding out that FRM could have been shut down in 2000 and should have been shut down in 2005-06 has compelled me to come forth with our story. I believe that those who were in position to have stopped them when they could and should have failed not only in their duties to protect New Hampshire citizens, but every victim that fell into the web of deceit weaved by the Bears. We did our best to bring them to the proper authorities' attention to no avail for whatever reason. We are just one of many families that the Bears would have, and in fact, have destroyed without blinking an eye. All of this, I believe, fueled by their lust for money. I know that one day the Bears will stand before the Lord, the true just judge, and give an account of all their deeds. There will be no lying to God. For that reason alone, I could have laid the situation down and had peace. But I believe our story needs to be heard to help the current victims. I have recently read a quote by Albert Einstein. I wanted to use this quote because I believe it to be the epitome of what has happened in this situation. He said, "It is not evil men we need to be afraid of. It is only when good men stand by and allow the evil, that is what we need to fear." For whatever reason, too many people have allowed both of the Bears to get away with their evil for too long. Neither of them have shown remorse for the harm they have caused. On the contrary, they seem to be continuing in their deceptions. I can only assume they do so in the hopes that Bob Farah will not be found guilty. I can only assume that they do so in the hopes that Bob Farah will not be found fully accountable for his role in all of this. I know that both men are intelligent, and I personally would be shocked if they do not have any money hidden away. My prayers are with the current victims in the situation. I have heard that there have been two suicides as a direct result of this FRM Fair matter. The people have lost houses and other horrible stories. The Fairs did not take a person's age or any forethought of them at all. They worked, I believe, together to steal from people. The state of New Hampshire needs to, in my small and humble opinion, do everything within its power to ensure that these current victims receive restitution in any way possible because of its failure to stop these criminals when it could and should have. I cannot thank you enough for your time and allowing me to share what we went through. I hope that this information sheds light into the Bears' greed and that it will help the current victims in any way possible. Thank you very much, and may God bless you in your efforts to find out the truth.
I want to thank you for taking the time to prepare your statement and making yourself available today to read the statement into the record. It's also apparent to me that there are substantial documents to support your statement that have been provided. I will be reviewing those documents in my deliberations, and I want you to know that if in those deliberations I have any questions for you, I will contact you through the attorneys at the Bureau, and should any of those questions come about, please recall that you are under oath throughout the duration of these proceedings.
Yes, sir.
At this point in time, I have no specific questions for you, and I'm going to ask if Attorney Forcier or Attorney Spill have any specific questions. Gentlemen.
I do. Hi, Mrs. Stone, Eric Forcier, State of New Hampshire.
Hi.
I would just have a couple of questions. With respect to NIR, we've heard a lot of testimony about NIR and people discovering that the business was defunct. And I did some research into NIR because I know there's a little bit of confusion about the company. And I've spoken with the attorneys for NIR, and they indicate to me that NIR has never filed for bankruptcy. And today is a corporation in good standing. So I just want to understand how you came to believe that the company was defunct or didn't exist or what?
I was at Chris Cotta's office. He called NIR, and they got him on the phone, and he asked them if he could produce their paperwork to me. He brought out some documents where Goody Hannington had invested money through Bob Ferrer to Scott Ferrer. And I'm going to lose you on this phone.
Here, I'll put.
And so I actually talked to NIR, and they told me that they had not been in business since 2003.
His attorney
caused them to go out of business. So they may have come back. I don't know the situation there, but other than, you know, just that was the conversation I had with them at my lawyer's office.
Okay, and their attorney represented to you that they had gone bankrupt.
Well, he didn't say bankrupt, but they were out of business.
Out of business.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand it because I spoke with them. I did some research with the company out of Kansas, and I didn't see any indication that they went bankrupt. I understand that they may not have had any clients and may have been on the brink of bankruptcy, but I just want to clarify that I don't believe that they went actual bankrupt.
Okay, well, that's what we were told.
Okay, and I understand that. And Mr. Stone, if I may ask, did you have a conversation with Jeffrey Spill around the time of your lawsuit? Because that was not mentioned in the opening statement, but if I recall, I read somewhere that you had a conversation with Mr. Spill.
Yeah, you know, it's been so long since I even looked at this. My wife's been on top of this, and after we did the settlement, I've really not looked at the paperwork, and so I could have, but not. You know, I can't tell you for sure.
Okay, so you have no recollection of calling Mr. Spill at 05 or 06?
I couldn't tell you right now.
Okay, that's fair.
You know, I mentioned to the FBI that why didn't they subpoena my phone records? Because, you know, I talked to the state I don't know how many times and for how many hours. You know, I was ready to yell at anybody what was going on. So, you know, I can easily tell you I talked to the Attorney General's office a couple hours. You know, and it would be the Attorney General himself, whoever answered the phone, you know, and I went over everything about Scott and everything, and they even echoed back to me that they had heard those stories before. So it wasn't any new news to anybody, just nobody did anything.
Okay, I just wanted to know if you remember talking to the Securities Bureau, because I thought I'd seen that at some point.
Well, I remember, you know, I think I had a conversation and, you know, just recently that, you know, they were asking me where, if I had gone to the securities. I didn't remember where the building was. You know, I traveled around Conca there, and he pointed out that it sounded like I went to the securities building. You know, described it.
This is so that you know that the conversation my husband was referring to was the conversation with Mr. Head, Mr. Marshall.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay.
and they were trying to ascertain where you may have gone to, and they were trying to...
Yeah, I had actually physically driven down there and tried to go in and make a statement or write a report. You know, like I said, I tried everything I could do in my power to get these guys, and, you know, I hit a wall every time. Either there was, you couldn't file something because you had them in court, there was a lawsuit going on, or, you know, and I even went to, I don't have anything in front of me, and, you know, like I said, I kind of put this away.
Okay, that's understandable. I just wanted to see if we could clarify that, because I'd seen something. Yeah. Did you file a written complaint with anybody at the time?
No, I hadn't. I think, in fact, my brother, just before I was going to send one, sent one to the Attorney General's office, and so I said, well, that should suffice.
Except, like I told you in my statement, I came across some of our handwritten notes.
Oh, you were.
And where Andrea Shaw had told Ron to write a letter to the New Hampshire Banking Department. And I can't say 100% if we did or didn't. I just know that I've lost the notes and we never heard anything.
Okay, that's fair. And another thing I wanted to ask you, you mentioned, Mrs. Stoney mentioned that Bob Farah, did you say that he would not necessarily solicit lenders, but speak about his son's company from the pulpit while...
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, I can tell you the whole conversation right off the top of my head, that one.
Well, he did it more than one time, though.
Yeah, he was up there, and he was telling a story about how somebody had prophesied that Scott would be a great minister at some point. And he said he didn't believe that because his son was such a great investor. He thought that he should be handling money instead of being a prophet. You know, they recorded these, and that was why the tapes were so important. Those were broadcasts over public television.
Okay. So then those tapes burned in the fire, right? So you're
okay. Well, they didn't really have any information. And we also found out, I just remembered this during our court procedures, that we had found out that Susan Farah had gone to the public access and gotten all the records, or all the tapes. And then after that was when we were trying to get them, and they said that half of them burned up in the house fire that Richard Rawick had, supposedly, when he just brought the tapes home.
How much money in total did you lend to FRM at the time of your lawsuit?
I put in my 401k, which was about $135,000, and my father's maybe about $125,000.
The total amount was, I believe, it wasn't quite that much big. It was $234,000, but a little bit.
And I just want to understand the lawsuit, the settlement, and the gag order. If you loaned $234,000, what was the amount that you settled for?
We can't answer that.
Yeah.
That's part of the
guideline? That's my testimony, unless you can get something from the bear thing that we can talk about.
Well, actually, you don't have to get anything. You can look at the records at the Banking Commission and see.
Okay, I'll try to do so. I just want to understand if they paid a lot, and I know you don't want to talk about that. I'm just trying to understand if they paid a lot in excess of how much you loaned as sort of a silence fee, or any way they didn't want to be exposed, and that's why they
got to look at the records.
And that's
I'll do so.
Mr. Forster, in my letter that I just read, that Susan Farah they paid a little extra on top of what we had to put on the, you know, or what we felt like we had to put as an offer on the table. They accepted that offer, and then my husband wanted them to give me a letter of apology, and they refused to do so. So they paid a little bit more on top of that, instead of the letter.
I understand. Okay. Just give me a moment to review my notes.
Yeah. Also, you know, when you go to look at that filing.
Yep.
That's paperwork that Scott Farah gave the Banking Commission. Okay, that's not, you'll notice that their names are on it and our names are not. So that's all paperwork that came from the Farahs. Everything that's been generated that you're looking at is what the Farahs wanted you to see.
I understand that, and I'll look to those documents to try to find out some of those answers that I was asking. I appreciate you directing me to where I might be able to find those.
Okay.
I don't believe I have any other further questions at this time. One moment, please. Another thing that I come across in the file for financial resources and assistance was a letter from Randall Stone written to our office at the Securities Bureau. Is it possible you're mistaken in your opening statement when you say that that letter was written to the Attorney General's office?
I could be.
Or is it possible that he wrote to two different agencies?
It may have been. We can find out for sure and let you know later.
We certainly appreciate it. Yeah, we do have a copy of a letter from, I believe, in the spring of 06 to our office.
Yeah.
07, I'm sorry, 07. So if you want to check that out a little bit further with your brother, it would be appreciated.
No problem.
I don't have any further questions at this time.
Mr. Spill, do you have any?
No question.
I do. This is Mr. Chandler again. And again, thank both of you. I'm intrigued by the settlement of your litigation. And I'm not going to ask you to violate any so-called gag order relative to the amount. But could you help me understand a few facets of that?
Okay.
One, can you give me a time frame around which that the settlement funds were transmitted?
Just I can't. Well, here's the deal. The Bob Fair was supposed to be deposed on Monday, and we were supposed to go into trial on a Tuesday. And the settlement was before he could be deposed.
Can you give me a year?
Yeah, 06. And I want to say it was May or April of 06.
Okay. So bear with me. So it's fair to say that the transmittal of funds in the settlement of your civil litigation was 06.
Yes, sir.
And from your opening statement, I observed that you recognize that the creation of CL&M Inc. as an entity was around 05.
Yes, sir. And I found that information out after Scott closed his doors in 09.
Can you, if you know, give me any information as to the methodology of the transfer of funds either directly to you or to your attorney?
Went to my attorney and then to me.
Do you know how it went to your attorney?
I saw a check from Susan Farrer.
A trust fund.
Yeah, from a Susan Farrer trust fund signed by Susan Farrer. And we had documentation, and in fact, I think you can go to Cal County. There's actually a deed written in there. They sold the antenna that was at Scott's business, place of business there. They received money for that.
At the time of settlement and the receipt of the funds, Did you see in that settlement process any reference to CL&M Inc.?
No.
No, that was, as I stated, it was JLN that was that we dealt with, and that supposedly was the CEO of that company was Richard Rollick, and that was the company we had been involved with that never even had a license.
But there's okay. But let me back up. Not having seen anything from CL&M Inc., you're absolutely certain that the check which transmitted the funds for your settlement came from Susan Farrer via a trust. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yes?
No, I was just going to say one of the stipulations in our settlement was that they had to prove where the money came from.
So that we knew that they weren't stealing from other people to pay us back.
And that was given to us in documentation that they sold the rights to that antenna on top of the hill there where he used to have his business. And that's where the proceeds of that money came to us.
I have nothing further at this time. Remember that as I review the documents you've provided in support of your statement, I may yet have questions.
Okay.
Yes, that's fine.
And please remember that if I do contact you with any of those questions, what that contact will be through the attorneys of the Bureau, and in responding to questions from me, you will remain under oath until these hearings close.
Yes, sir.
That's understood, Mr. Stone?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I have nothing further. Attorney Forsey, anything further?
No, sir.
Attorney Spill?
No, sir.
Again, thank you very much for taking the time to make yourself available to testify telephonically, and thank you very much for the prepared statement and the documents you provided to me.
Mr. Taylor, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity.
Have a good one.
Mr. Chandler,
that concludes the testimony of the Stones. We're not going off the record yet. Attorney Forster.
I just wanted the piece of paper I spoke about, the letter from the attorneys for NIR. I just thought maybe you'd want to have that on the record. It was a letter. I spoke to Attorney Turner, who represented NIR in a lawsuit by Financial Resources. And I just asked him, basically, we've heard a lot of the testimony about the company being bankrupt, and I've done some internet research, and I just can't seem to see any bankruptcy records or any. So could you tell me? And he said they never were bankrupt.
I believe in your PowerPoint presentation, there was a component of that that related to NIR. There was a small hiatus in the early 2000s relative to the registration of NIR, and that was corrected by a subsequent amended filing in...
My understanding of that, if I may interject there, is in November 2004, they lost their corporate status for failure to pay fees. In March of 2005, they were reinstated. But this speaks to their bankruptcy and not their corporate status.
I have seen, nor have I really accepted with any credibility, any evidence of bankruptcy of any kind relative to NIR, and I think your documentation is sound. So I don't feel that it's necessary for me to accept that.
Understand.
Any other matters before we take a break?
No, sir.
No, sir.
Attorney Spill. Okay, we're done. We're going to go off. We are off the record. This is Mr. Chandler. I'm going to declare that it is 12:30 on the 21st of December 2010. We are back on the record. In the FRM hearing, so-called, we had one witness scheduled for this afternoon, Mr. Joseph Austin, who is, for whatever reason, unable to attend and will be scheduled, I believe, now tentatively for early in the proceedings on January the 5th. Before I recess for the day, Attorney Forsier, Attorney Spill, are there any matters that need to come this afternoon?
I expected Attorney Wingate up with a request for a subpoena to be signed, but that can be handled.
I can sign that off the record.
Yeah, that can be handled.
You can present to me who that is and why it is, and I'll that doesn't have to be done on the record. That's fine.
Other than that, nothing further.
There being nothing else, then we are adjourned for the day.